You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama.
Listen to the King and ask yourself, who would you rather have for a big brother, Elvis or John Wayne? To generations of young adults, Elvis was more than a rock star, a rebel, or a fat guy in sequins. He was, especially early in his career, a role model who shaped the way America thought about manhood and gender. He was the antithesis of John Wayne. While some cultural critics have said that role models in the second half of the 20th century were few and far between, our guest this hour argues that rock and roll filled that gap and helped boomers to learn what it meant to be honest, multidimensional men and women. Men learned that it was okay to cry and to show vulnerability, and women took charge of their sexuality and their own power. Today we talk about the songs that changed our ideas about gender in America. I hope you'll join in with your own memories about the songs that made you who you are. Do you think rock and roll is a good medium for positive change? Is it even fair to call it a positive influence on gender? And what did Mick Jagger teach you? The number to join in the conversation is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, try 263-1890, 263-1890. Our guest this hour is Tim Riley. He's the pop critic for NPR's midday news magazine, Here and Now, and the author of the book, Fever: How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim Riley, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
Let's start at the beginning of rock and roll. And, of course, at the beginning is Elvis Presley. What made Elvis a new role model for young people?
Well, Elvis was, of course, the first guy to stand up and shake his hips and imitate sort of black stylings in both his vocal mannerisms and in his body movements. And this was a huge radical change from the way singers presented themselves in the mid-50s, largely because he presented himself as a sexual object, as somebody whose physicality not only suggested sexuality, but overtly sort of dramatized the sexual act while he was singing. And this was completely alien to mainstream wonderbread culture in the Eisenhower 50s, where the reigning archetype for manhood was John Wayne. And John Wayne, you know, stood for all of those World War II vets, the generation we call the greatest generation now. And they really just had no notion that sexualizing their body was a manly thing to do. So Elvis Presley springs up and presents this new image of man as someone that's highly sexualized. And it's a very radical idea. And among all of the radical ideas that Presley presented when he first appeared, you know, ideas about race, ideas about class, ideas about the generation gap, the one about manhood is the one that's least investigated, that's been least explored, and that's why I wanted to write this book.
So, and John Wayne, he was pretty much the going symbol of manhood. I mean, this is pretty much all people had to aspire to for quite some time, right?
Well, he was. He wasn't the only one, of course. There were a lot of different variations. He was the largest one. He was the most popular one, and he was the one from which most men drew their idea of manhood. And even if you had, say, another movie star like James Stewart, you know, who was going to be a very different kind of man than John Wayne, he perceived and built his persona almost as a reaction to Wayne. That is, it was impossible to understand James Stewart's idea of manhood without understanding Wayne as well. So, and in a movie like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, these two are pitted against each other, and Wayne is the dominant one, and you know Wayne is going to be the superior one, the one who's going to win out in the end, and that's exactly the way that plot plays out.
Tim, sorry to interrupt, but are you on a cell phone by any chance?
No, but I'm on a wireless. Let me get on a landline here.
Yeah, I think that might be a little clearer connection.
Hello, is that better?
Ah, yes, much better.
Oh,
thank
good.
You. Now you sound like you're in the same country. So you were talking about John Wayne, and you say that Elvis responded. Did he consciously respond? Did he want to be the antidote to John Wayne, or was this sort of just something bubbling in his unconscious?
Well, I think a large part of Elvis Presley's genius is that it's an intuitive genius, and a large portion of it is unconscious. Just the way a large portion of his audience was responding unconsciously to the values of their parents. I mean, we have sort of what I've set up here is that John Wayne is sort of Elvis Presley's fictional father, and we have the son rebelling against the father, and we have the son rebelling against all of the father's customs and traditions and habits and ways of presenting himself. And this is why Presley was so popular, was that he clearly struck a nerve in his audience, and there were a lot of young people out there who felt the same impulse to rebel in the same ways against what their parents had taught them about sexuality, about how to carry themselves, about how to conduct themselves, and how to relate to each other. It was clear that a lot of the principles that Wayne carried really didn't make any sense to these young kids. They confronted the world with a whole new set of ideas, with a whole new set of values, and they just began acting them out when they were teenagers and young adults. And so, you know, I think that Presley represented sort of the larger unconscious impulse in that teenage audience of his.
And you got to admit that Elvis definitely made being a man look like more fun than John Wayne did.
Well, you know, but I don't really want to sound disrespectful to Wayne. I admire John Wayne a great deal, and I admire the values of that Greatest Generation a great deal. They simply come from a very different imaginative space. They came from a space that had to go to Europe and confront a very evil power, and you know, on the beaches of Normandy, and those were really great sacrifices these men made, and they tended to ingrain in them certain values and certain attitudes that stuck with them that their children just didn't really appreciate and or understand. In other words, the freedom and prosperity that the Greatest Generation was able to build for those kids, the kids understood in terms of in completely different kinds of freedom. When you're 19 and you haven't seen friends killed on the beaches of Normandy, you just really can't appreciate it. All you can see is this mass of riches and unfolding, developing sexuality in your own body that's very exciting, and it's liberating, and your feeling is, well, gosh, this, you know, the world is full of possibilities. Let's go out there and have fun. Whereas the John Wayne man is very staid and stoic and has sacrificed a great deal and is much more sober when he reflects on life.
So one of the symptoms of the fact that Elvis didn't go through what John Wayne would have went through, or John Wayne's generation, is probably his soft side. He had a vulnerability about him, didn't he?
Well, this is of course one of the major ways in which he rebelled, was that in the way he approached women, the way he idealized women, the way he spoke to women, the way he wooed women. John Wayne's wooing of women is never considered one of his strong points, you know. And Elvis Presley decided to woo women with a completely different approach, and it's one of the key themes of what I write about in my book. And that is, there is, you know, to the masculine personality, there is a vulnerability, there is a soft side, there is a way of wooing a woman that meets her completely on her own terms. In fact, rock and rollers are known should be celebrated for being the first style to actually have the man sing up in the female register in falsetto voice. All the doo-wop groups, you think of singers like Brian Wilson, The falsetto romance is really a key piece of rock and roll. And what is that about? That's about the man cultivating his feminine aspect. It's about the man leaping into a high voice to try and imitate the sound of the woman and to try and project to her, this is how beautiful I think you are. This is how badly I want to imitate your sound.
I don't know if Elvis sang in falsetto, but you can hear him in his recordings. He just croons so tenderly, the way only Elvis can, and he sounds vulnerable and soft, and you can just hear it in the recordings. And we've got some vintage Elvis here. Let's take a listen.
lonesome tonight? Do you miss me tonight? Are you sorry we drifted apart? Does your memory stray to a bright?
So, Tim Riley, what message does a soft song like this send to young people?
Well, I think it's a way of, I mean, it's very interesting. I love this song, and I talk about this song in the book, and I think it's very interesting the way he opens up and shows this vulnerable side to his personality as a way of wooing this love object in the song. And it, you know, when you hear that song, you think nothing. You think of tenderness, you think of warmth, you think, this is a man who wants to cuddle. And yet, this is not in any way a reflection on any kind of weakness in his manhood. In other words, here's a man who feels strong enough to say, you know, I have emotion. I have the emotion of fear, the emotion of sensitivity, of feeling tender, and I want to nuzzle up to my loved one. And these are things that are completely alien to the John Wayne persona. It's impossible to imagine John Wayne delivering this song.
Didn't he call it music for goons?
Well, this is part of the success of Elvis Presley's stylistic breakthrough is that the older generation was so threatened by it. And Frank Sinatra was actually the guy who called rock and roll music for goons. Mm. He was very anti-rock and roll. He was part of that greatest generation. This was simply abhorrent to them. Their whole idea of manhood was built on the idea of strength and hiding your feelings, repressing your sexuality. You know, sexuality was not an open matter in the mid-50s. It was something that was, we had a veneer, and we focused on that veneer, and everybody, you know, behavior may have been kind of similar. I think it was quite similar off stage, but on stage, there was this idea about sexuality as something that was quite chaste and rarefied and something that was done, you know, in the sanctity of marriage. And, you know, Elvis Presley, really, we see the seeds, we see the stirrings of the entire sexual revolution there.
Is this something that continued throughout his career? I mean, maybe not counting the sequins phase, but I mean, is this healthy exuberance something that he carried with him and conveyed all throughout his career?
Well, I think so, but it's very important to make the distinction in Elvis Presley's career between his musical career and his Hollywood career, because Hollywood really had no idea what to do with him. So they packaged him up as a plastic teen idol, and they marched him through a bunch of boring movies. And the movies are actually, they're just unbearable and unwatchable anymore. Hollywood just had no idea what to do with him. It was a kind of energy it was completely alien to them. And so they packaged him and promoted him as a teen movie star, but he continued to make fabulous recordings. And his recordings all through the 60s, I would argue, still represent a great aesthetic triumph, especially when he goes back to Memphis in 1968 and he makes a record at the age of 33 called Elvis in Memphis. That is, a lot of these same values embedded in adult material. So he really does graduate from a teen star into an adult rock star at that point.
We're talking this hour with Tim Riley. He's the pop critic for NPR's Midday News magazine Here and Now and the author of the book Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. I'll be talking with him a bit more after this break. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you. I'm sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking today about rock and roll and how it transformed gender ideas in America. Everybody from Elvis to Tina Turner to the Kinks. If you've got a story about how rock and roll changed you, maybe a particular song that changed the way you felt and you never felt the same after, give us a call and share that with us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And in Madison, the number is 263-1890. 263-1890. Our guest, Tim Riley, the pop music critic, rather the pop critic for NPR's Midday News magazine, Here and Now, and the author of the book Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim Riley, we were talking about Elvis, and you were making the distinction between his Hollywood career, which was decidedly lackluster, and his onstage persona as a singer. And I think it's fair to talk about his personal life as well. On stage, obviously, he was this dynamic, incredible figure who no doubt influenced lots of people. But what about his personal life? Because fans are known for following personal lives as well as performing careers. And I would think that his personal life would be an area that might be a little dodgier.
Oh, definitely a lot dodgier. You know, and as a critic, what I say is this. I am much more interested in the performance text of a given recording artist than I am in their personal lives. I just think it's richer, it's more poetic, it's more fun to listen to and look at and think about. The personal life, to me, is something lower on a scale of interesting subject matter. And, you know, the prime example of that really is Frank Sinatra. I mean, Sinatra's personal life is an absolute disaster, as are a lot of these people's, you know. I mean, it's just the nature of showbiz is that their personal lives are really... You know, as Steve Martin said, you know, well, we sleep with so many different people. So I'm much more interested in the performance text and in Frank Sinatra's persona as a singer than I am in his persona as a private citizen.
But people do follow the personal lives, and that must wield an influence of its own.
Well, it's important to know that the personal life does play into the persona, that the way these things get reported and the kind of persona that develops over a long career like Sinatra's or Presley's incorporates many facets of the decisions they make in their personal life. There's no question about that. I just place an emphasis on the recorded work and on the interpretations that they're doing of their songs. That's just my bias as a critic. But if we're going to talk about the personal life, what you understand then is that the personal life is at odds with the substance of their singing style and a lot of the material they interpret. For example, when he sings... you know, he's getting a divorce from Priscilla, and he sings Suspicious Minds. And it's very difficult to suspend your knowledge of his actual divorce from what you hear in that song, which is a great deal of rage and humiliation and anger and pain and deep distress at the idea that both parties have grown so suspicious of one another that they can't continue in their marriage because the jealousy is just out of control. And that makes that a very powerful song, because you understand that he's actually going through a divorce in the period when he's singing that song. So sometimes these associations are very relevant, very important, and very difficult to unravel from the song itself. I would say that in my book, Presley is a much greater hero as a singer than he is as someone who would serve as a role model mm-hmm. in their personal life.
Isn't the territory Elvis was covering for men... vulnerability, charisma, this sort of ethic of fun. Wasn't that sort of some of the same territory that James Dean and Marlon Brando were covering in film?
Well, exactly. And this is what is so curious, is that Elvis Presley, of course, was a huge Marlon Brando fan and a huge James Dean fan. And when he met the director to Rebel Without a Cause, he literally fell to his knees and started reciting whole excerpts from the script to this director. And Elvis definitely took a lot of cues from Marlon Brando and James Dean and Montgomery Clift and several others. And these were method actors who really cultivated this idea of the man is vulnerable. And this was half of what was shocking and new about all these young actors who started hitting the screen. What's curious, though, is that those actors, although they had careers, they really were not as influential in the cultural development of the idea of manhood as Elvis Presley was through his music.
Why is that?
Well, I think that they sort of got jump-started in Hollywood, and then Hollywood had sort of a smothering effect on them. Of course, Montgomery Clift and James Dean died young, and Marlon Brando went on to have a very long career, but a very erratic and kind of uneven career. It was kind of like he couldn't turn his sensibility into a galvanizing force in the system of Hollywood that had developed. And because rock and roll, because the music business was largely unshapen back in those days, especially compared to what we know nowadays, Presley did become that galvanizing force, and he did snowball into a much larger, more intricate, rich, varied, complicated persona than any of those earlier heroes of his. I mean, it's very curious to us rock critics that Hollywood hasn't produced anything nearly as interesting as Elvis Presley in the past 50 years.
Well, part of it is that Elvis was real. This was all coming from his gut, whereas you get the idea sometimes with the other people we mentioned, Brando and Dean, that there was sort of this pastiche over them, this veneer that wasn't always honest.
Well, wasn't always honest. I mean, Brando is just such an eccentric. He's so unique. He's so much in his own world. I mean, you get the feeling with Brando sometimes that he's in his own world even when he's in a movie with lots of other people. I mean, it's kind of like he can be so original and unique that he's distracting in his own movies, because you just wonder what is going on in that guy's head. He's so unusual. I think is kind of a unique case. I mean, I don't think there's anybody that's ever been like Brando or ever inhabits a movie the way Brando does. Presley, however, has a very interesting, it's a curious case of how the energy was, again, it was so eccentric and so unique that even though Hollywood tried to gobble it up, they couldn't, that he kept making records and he kept snowballing as a persona, and he was uncontainable. It was like the forces of the Hollywood show business machine that set to work around him. They were able to sort of neuterize him for the movies he appeared in, but they were nowhere near able to neuterize the entire persona.
I want to go and take some phone calls now. Oh, we just lost our first call, so let's go and take a call from John in Shawano. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I was listening to the radio, and I just wanted to comment about the how music changes a person's life. There,
mm-hmm.
I guess the type of music that influenced me was like punk and ska music. I'm not sure if it's any relation to.
Mm-hmm.
Hope.
And how did that? How did it change you? Did it change the way you thought about yourself or your identity as a man?
Correct. I was in the service for about 4 years, and pretty much the last year that I was in, I had a buddy that was in there that he listened to it, and he kind of got me into listening to it, and I guess what it made me think about was just one man's idea can change a point of view on one thing, but I knew, you can't do that in the service because it's not a democratic society in there, it's do what you're told, and that's, they want you to think on how their basis is, but not your basis.
So you probably picked up a defiance from punk music.
Not much defiance, more of an independent way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, it really wasn't getting really kosher with me for me being in the service and doing that, thinking at the same time. And it made a lot more sense, I guess, in a way to me about the... about how I wanted to live.
What bands influenced you, John?
I don't think it's much of a band. I think pretty much all of the music influenced me. It's the a lot of the words and how they're putting it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't take it to an extreme, anarchy extreme. But more of a political view way.
Tim Riley.
Yeah, I think what our caller is saying is very interesting, because punk was a very interesting moment in the history of rock and roll. The way one critic put it was, it was a bunch of bands who were trying to kill off rock and roll, and by trying to kill it off, they discovered the only way they could keep it alive, which I think is sort of the central irony alive in punk rock. I can't imagine what a disruptive influence punk rock must have had for someone in the service. It must have been a huge upheaval of imagination to be in the service and then to be embracing punk rock. The interesting thing that happens to the idea of manhood in punk rock is that punk rock is really not interested at all in sexuality. I mean, and that's a fairly alien concept inside rock and roll, to be sort of anti-sexual. But we have, who are the key figures in punk rock would be Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols And he is not a sex symbol, and he does not romance women, and he does not care about getting laid. I mean, this is just the furthest thing from his mind. He has a very severe political agenda, and he's intensely sardonic and sarcastic. And of course, the other guy from the Sex Pistols is Sid Vicious, who is just a man who has no idea how to live a life. Mm-hmm. He's just a complete walking disaster. And
he was kind of a sex symbol, though, wasn't he? I remember having a poster of him. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, Sid Vicious, you know, God help him. What was he a symbol for? Was he a symbol? He was a symbol for disaffected youth, for people who wanted such a firm, hard and fast rejection of established values that, you know, at the cost of their own self-respect and it's very curious to me because he's such a pathetic figure that he's not even tragic. I mean, he really just is. He's the man without a clue, Sid Vicious. And if the band hadn't broken up, he would have been the first thing they would have done was to kick Sid Vicious out because none of them could stand him. And he had carved I want some smack or I want some heroin. Mm. He carved it in a knife on his chest. I mean, here's a guy who just is loser with a capital L. And yet, you listen to a recording of him singing the Frank Sinatra song, I Did It My Way, and it's a thoroughly enjoyable kind of performance in a very dark, mischievous kind of, you know, but still compelling kind of way. A very curious figure. Not somebody that, I hope not somebody that you would take as a role model.
Let's go to Brian in Hudson. Hi, Brian, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Morning.
See, I was just thinking that you were saying Elvis broke down social constraints, kind of following the John Wayne way of doing things, and it just seems like immediately after following Elvis, you know, you had the Rolling Stones and whatnot, and just it just made it just so much easier to follow the Mick Jagger's line of just encouraging your pursuit of your most base instincts, narcissism, kind of a race towards the bottom, it seems to me. I don't know if the Sex Pistols had nothing to do with sex, but it just seems like it's so much easier just to satisfy your own adolescent urges, and it kind of, I don't know, it just seemed to reflect on the way our society has changed to where it's no longer, you no longer encourage self-sacrifice. It's to live for the moment, kind of the drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
So, Brian, you don't see that as a positive influence at all?
I don't see it as a, I mean, it's fun. Don't get me wrong, you know. I like rock and roll, too. But on a more basic societal level, the influence that, let's face it, 18-year-olds want to be encouraged to have fun, you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll. And but it's pretty much all I had to say.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Tim Riley?
Well, he brings up Mick Jagger, who is one of the most curious cases in the subject of rock and roll and manhood. And you have to understand that Mick Jagger was reviled, even among his peers in the 60s, for the kinds of dancing he did. John Lennon is famous for calling Mick Jagger, he hated Mick Jagger's faggot dancing. And that's a quote from the homophobic John Lennon in 1970. And he thought all that dancing was distracting and unnecessary, and, you know, it didn't really help you focus in on the music of what was being said. Mick Jagger obviously takes what Elvis Presley started, this highly eroticized idea of the male body, and takes it even further and turns dancing into a way of flirting with his entire audience. And, of course, with the long hair, you're talking about a really, you know, a supercharged androgynous male sex figure here. What's really fascinating to me about Mick Jagger is that is pretty much the end of where that discussion about Mick Jagger lies. And what's fascinating to me is that he's actually one of the great intellectuals in rock and roll, and he writes actually very interesting, pointed, complicated portraits of women to the point where his personal life is all screwed up like everybody's in show business, but it stands as the most ironic personal life given the kind of reverence he seems to have for women in his songs. And the Stones are always the first on everyone's hit list for, oh, these are misogynists, and these guys treat women like dirt, and these guys are really the bad boys of rock and roll, and blah, blah, blah. And yet, to go to the text, to go to the songs, and try and listen to and find proof in the songs that they hate women, it's just not there. It's just this vast assumption, generalizations that's built up around the Rolling Stones that doesn't hold any water. For example, Under My Thumb, which is thought to be or generally perceived to be a song about, you know, getting a girl under your control as a man, as a male lover. That's not what the song is about at all. It's about revenge. It's the woman once had him under her thumb, and now the tables have turned, and I've got you under my thumb. It's about a power struggle in a relationship. It's not a simple matter at all. And so I think Mick Jagger is one of the key, most interesting people to look at in rock and roll, and I devote a lot of time to him in my book.
And as you said, Mick Jagger, one of the early figures of androgyny, right? And he's sort of in the line of David Bowie, and then I'm thinking of the song Lola from the Kinks. This all sort of gets wrapped up in the same package.
Yeah. Well, Lola from the Kinks is a very radical song for 1970. I think it's 1970. It's a song about a young, I left home just a week before, and I never ever met a woman before, but Lola smiled and took me by the hand, said, "Little boy, I'm going to make you a man." It's about a guy who, I think in my head, it's kind of a country bumpkin who goes to the city, hits the dance floor, and meets his first transvestite, and is absolutely knocked over, because he's eroticized by this figure, but he has no clue what to make of it. He has no clue what to make of this feeling that's surging through his veins. I think this is a man, but I am turned on because it looks like a woman. And he absolutely cannot make sense of it. And the transvestite in the song is really a charming character, because the transvestite just smiles knowingly and says, you're just a newbie. We'll get you going here, you know. It's a very sympathetic figure in the song. I've always just loved that song. And that song really is just a giant bomb that gets dropped on 70s culture. And, of course, 70s culture explodes with androgynous themes from then on.
Well, we've actually got a little bit of Lola. Let's take a listen.
Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like cherry cola, C-O-L-A cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said Lola, L-O-L-A Lola, 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 Lola.
That, of course, is Lola from the Kinks. Our guest this hour is Tim Riley. He is pop critic for NPR's Midday News magazine, Here and Now, and the author of the book Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. We'll be talking with him again in just a moment. If you want to join in the conversation this morning, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, and today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11 today, the talk turns to pet care as Larry Mueller talks with Dr. Stephen Sabella, a veterinarian with the Wisconsin Humane Society. And then at 12:30, stay tuned for Chapter a Day. Hear readings from the personal memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant. It's Chapter a Day at 12:30. Our guest this hour, Tim Riley. He's the author of the book Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. And we're going to take a call now from Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh, go ahead.
Hi. First of all, falsetto. Falsetto was often in the Western movies where the cowboy and his band would sing, and falsetto, I think, was common there, and therefore it was also common in country music. if you listen to some of the Hank Williams, and it was also with the Ink Spots, black music that was very popular in the white community. I think all of these influences were around before Elvis. Elvis, of course, the difference, if you look at a Hank Williams singing, at least on tape, he's very rigid. He's not moving his hips or anything like that. There is a difference in the portrayal of the Western cowboy is not moving around like Elvis. The contrast, though, you say with John Wayne, I think the main contrast at that time would have been more with Pat Boone, who represented the middle class, the bourgeois approach. He was more what the middle class parents wanted their kids to be like. Indeed, in my city, there was the Elvis versus Pat Boone role played out in a class. I won't say class warfare, but there were the fraternity boys often wore white buck shoes and would be associated more with Pat Boone. And in my city, there were the frats and the cats who wore their white T-shirts with the cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve and the hairstyle of Elvis and so forth. So you did have this contrast. Elvis went in the army. Of course, he had the draft at the time, and Elvis's hair was cut. And I think this makes him a lot more palatable with the older generation. On the other hand, in the South, where I came from, there were towns that outlawed rock and roll, seeing it as sexy and black and all the other things that the Bible Belt South tended not to like. There it's not just Elvis though. The movie that he liked so much, he said, was with Rebel Without a Cause. And of course, there you have the family, you have the alternate family portrayed as good, and the family of family values portrayed as wrong. You have Minio Woodward. Not Woodward, but I can't think of her name. Natalie Wood and Dean as the counter family, mm-hmm. which is good, and somehow each one of their real families are horrible. You have a trend away from the traditional values in the 50s, and of course it accelerates as time goes on.
Thanks for the call, Hugh. Tim Riley, what do you think?
Well, Hugh, what a call! You just set off so many different things to talk about. Thank you so much for the call. First of all, talking about falsetto, I in no way wanted to suggest that rock and roll was the first style to use falsetto, and he makes a very excellent point that we had the Ink Spots, black culture used a lot of falsetto, R&B, and in doo-wop, and in country and western music, falsetto, or as it was sometimes referred to more formally as yodeling, and these are very important strands that Elvis Presley unites in rock and roll. The point I wanted to make about rock and roll falsetto was that it's used for a very distinctive purpose, which is to bring out and feminize an essentially or a previously male sensibility or a male trait. So it is the man self-consciously trying to sound like a woman. And that's a very important theme in early rock and roll that gets picked up by a lot of different people. The key person that I write about that picks this theme up, a man who sounds like a woman, is Smokey Robinson. And he's a very important figure in early 60s rock and roll who writes from both the male and the female perspective. And he's a songwriter who's been overlooked in this idea about gender and rock and roll. Some of the other points that he brought up that I'll just touch on, the idea that there are these contrasting families in that movie, Rebel Without a Cause. That's an excellent point, and the movie is definitely written that way. What I'd like to point out is that James Dean, the central conflict in his family is between he and his father. And it's very important to understand that James Dean is frustrated and very, very conflicted about his feelings for his father. It's a mixture of respect and love and complete frustration, complete anger that his father doesn't seem to connect with him or to want to connect with him. And this is a key theme of Rebel Without a Cause. And, of course, this is the theme that Elvis responded to so overwhelmingly, and which much of the audience did, too. And then, if I could just point forwards a bit, we've been talking a lot about Elvis Presley, but this theme, this tension between the boy and his father, is the key theme that a later figure in rock and roll writes about and chooses as his central theme of material, and that's Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen has more songs about the son trying to reach out to the father and feeling frustrated and aggravated about the father. That is one of his key themes in all his music, and of course Springsteen has built a rather rich and varied poetic catalog based on a lot of that manhood material.
We've talked a lot about fathers and sons and ideas about manhood and being a man. We haven't really hit on women yet.
Yeah.
Who do you think stands out there in the field as someone who changed the direction that gender was thought of?
Well, rock's first feminist and the key analog to Elvis Presley is Tina Turner. And Tina Turner was a cyclone who blew through rock and roll. Ironically, did not become popular until her 1970 hit with John Fogerty's Proud Mary. But inside rock and roll, the waves she was creating were very significant. Her earliest top 40 hit was a song called A Fool in Love from 1960, which is the most ironic thing about it is that it maps out her entire career. Why is this woman involved with this man when he treats her so bad? Why does she keep loving him when he treats her so bad? She's a fool in love. He's also a fool in love. And the ironic thing about this song is that Ike Turner wrote it. So it's this very self-conscious projection of insecurity and awareness from Ike Turner. And Tina Turner sings it and turns it into a torch that most feminists will carry throughout the decade, the 60s and the 70s.
We've actually got a little bit of that one. Let's
take
a listen.
Great, let's listen to that.
You're just a fool. You know you're in love.
Wow, she's really got pipes.
Right. Just the most incredible pipes. I mean, she's really just this unquantifiable, great, you know, charisma cubed Tina Turner. I mean, if you could bottle sexuality, it would be Tina Turner, right?
Yeah, and the funny thing is people said she sang like a man.
Yeah. Very curious moment. Of course, they make this a key moment in the biopic that they made of Ike and Tina a few years ago, What's Love Got to Do with It? And after Ike hears her sing in the club, he sits her down in a cafe afterwards, and he said, I've never heard anything like it. You sang like a man. And it's this incredible thing, this idea that a woman could sing like a man. And what is he really saying there? Why is that so astonishing? What's going on there? It's really about how powerful and fierce Tina Turner is able to sing. You know, the power and the ferocity of her voice, the feral energy that she is able to project, it's almost like men are shocked to learn that women are tough, that women have fire inside of them, that women are not docile and feminine and soft, or at least not just that, but actually have a great deal of power and complexity that can project this with a huge amount of force. This is a rock and roll idea. And Tina Turner turns this into a feminist ideal long before we get Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. I mean, Tina Turner, to me, is the signal call to feminism in the early 1960s.
Yeah, you're right that. Did Betty Friedan ever express female indignation as brazenly as Tina Turner? And the thing that's amazing to me about that is that she did. I mean, this song, as you said, was written under Ike, and most of her career until we get to Private Dancer is under the yoke of Ike.
Yeah.
And she still embodies all these feminist ideals.
Yeah. Well, Ike, Ike is a fairly typical rock and roll band leader of the day, and he hears Tina Turner, and what he hears is a meal ticket. I mean, Ike had been slogging around the circuit of clubs and making recordings for a long time before he met Tina Turner. In fact, there's a whole way of looking at Ike Turner as doing his best work before he meets Tina Turner.
But he meets Tina Turner, and they turn into a duo act. And, of course, she dominates the stage. I mean, you can't take your eyes off Tina Turner when she's on stage. And Ike has this kind of complicated relationship with her. He's the band leader. He writes a lot of the material. He hires and fires the musicians. But she is clearly the star. She's the runaway star. So he has this, you know, he has this very vexed relationship with her. In fact, when Phil Spector approaches her to record River Deep Mountain High, Ike at first thinks that he's going to get tapped for this session too, and he's very disappointed to learn that Phil Spector wants only Tina Turner for the singer on that record. Hmm. And of course, the success of that record is a very ironic triumph for her, because it's very big in England, it doesn't break over here, and it sort of crystallizes the idea of Tina Turner as a major star, but it doesn't give her the career. She has to wait another 4 years to get her big top hit career.
And then it was on her own terms.
And then, well, Proud Mary is the hit with the Ike and Tina Turner Review, and 3 years later they're divorced. So this team works the circuit of clubs, and they play Vegas a lot for over 13 years. That The Fool in Love we just heard is 1960. But her first top 10 hit is John Fogerty's Proud Mary, 1970. And she divorces Ike in 1973, but it's not until 1985 that she has her first huge solo breakout hit with What's Love Got to Do with It. And that is the year that she appears in the movie, in the Mel Gibson movie, and you know, she releases her book, I, Tina, and becomes an enormous feminist icon. But she's kind of an icon in waiting until that point. But when she releases her book and tells her story, which everyone kind of knows this story, it's a fascinating kind of memoir because it's not very revelatory. I mean, everyone understood that Ike was a wife beater and a womanizer and just a horrible misogynist, and that Tina had actually survived him. Tina had divorced him and gone on and to have a big career without him, and she was actually a feminist hero before the book came out, and the book just solidified all these things that everyone already knew about Tina Turner.
Let's go back to the phones now. Here's a call from Scott in Johnson Creek. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. It's a really good program, Jim and Veronica.
Thank you.
Listening to it just gave me a lot of thoughts. As a young man growing up in the 70s, I related to Led Zeppelin, and Jimmy Page was always been my guitar hero, even till today. I could relate to the lyrics of the songs, and the Jimmy Page's sunburst Les Paul guitar, and the way he held it so low, and the way he played it, and the sloppy play, but heavy, thunderous rock and roll, and Robert Plant and his sort of feminine, kind of yet masculine vocals, and the lyrics themselves, like, literally help. I mean, it's even kind of nutty, but I bet a lot of people feel this way, that helped form my philosophy and identity and about things like love and relationships. And to this day, I listen to Led Zeppelin songs. Like, for instance, when I hear Heartbreaker, I think of my ex-wife, you know. And everyone has, it seems like, especially young men, have a idea who they like. Some people like The Who, the Stones, whatever. I just connected with Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin, and still to this day, I turn 42 tomorrow, and I tell you, I'm still digging on it. And I'll go home tonight and play a bunch after hearing this program. So,
well, thanks for the call, Scott.
Thank you.
What do you think, Tim Riley?
Well, thanks for the call, Scott. I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan, too, and I came of age in the 70s when Led Zeppelin were big, and we all knew that there were gods roaming the earth, and it was Led Zeppelin. And we also knew that they weren't the Beatles, and they were never going to be the Beatles, and the Beatles still reigned supreme, but that didn't matter because we had our own gods, and they were Led Zeppelin. And Jimmy Page, all of the things that Scott just described are true, and they are sort of an extension of everything we've talked about with Elvis Presley. Jimmy Page, you know, the key guitar hero of the 70s, the man who eroticized the playing of the guitar, the man who takes the idea of the phallic guitar and makes it, as explicit as possible. And not just that, but a wonderful guitar player as well, and a man of great musical ideas. I like what one critic said about
Led Zeppelin, which is that they were essentially genius dumb. And that is, by that I mean they had the genius to sort of to be low riders and to just take the common ordinary ideas and turn them into huge soaring rock and roll riffs. And they did it masterfully. I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan. And the singer Robert Plant is, you know, clearly an extension, an exaggerated form of all of that falsetto singing that we were talking about. The great thing about Robert Plant is that his singing is an imitation of an echo of the guitar that's going on around him. I mean, he takes the idea of the rock and roll singer and says, I want to try and sound like a guitar. And that's just such a cool idea, and he makes it work in a lot of different places in Led Zeppelin's music.
Well, Tim Riley, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
Thanks so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Tim Riley, he is the pop critic for NPR's Midday News magazine Here and Now, and the author of the book Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America, that one by St. Martin's Press. Thank you to Carmen Jackson, who produced this program, and to Doug Gordon, who helped us round up some music, and Randall Davidson. I'm Veronica Rickard, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.